Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it about Beethoven that makes his music sound so fresh even in the 21st century? And what can we still discover when we return to listen to works we think we know by heart? The tragic irony of this master composer still writing and conducting symphonies after losing his hearing makes his life story compelling. But what keeps him a household name nearly 300 years after his death is the revolutionary music he left behind. The Dallas Symphony Orchestra is hosting a Beethoven Festival starting May 1st. It's about 3 weeks of live special performances of Beethoven's compositions taking place at the Dallas City Performance Hall. So we have invited DSO Music Director Jaap van Zweden and Concertmaster Alex Carr to join us to talk about what it is like to conduct and perform Beethoven's creations and about what makes him such an enduring musical favorite around the world. Jaap and Alex, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So how did the idea come about for a Beethoven festival? And then how in the world do you decide which works to choose and in what order to present them?
Well, if I may start, I think that it's not for nothing that Beethoven is still, I think, among the most interesting, and you just said it in your beginning, revolutionary composers of his time. And he always surprises us every day again and again. Every day when you dig in the music, you find new things to discover, and the energy which you get actually from the music is always a fantastic joy to meet on stage. And to encourage the musicians to give their best. It's one of the best composers, actually, to pull the diamonds out of the box, as you can say, with this great orchestra. And I think once in a while, it's very, very good for the also for the quality of playing that we take this composer out of the box and just shine him. And the great thing about this festival is that we don't only show some great symphonies and concertos, but also chamber music. And then especially the violin sonatas, the piano violin sonatas, which are going to be played by Alex and Nathan and another violinist.
Gian,
yes, who is a great violinist from here, actually. So, and some other chamber music around that. So it's not only concentrated on the orchestra, but it is also concentrated on the chamber music of Beethoven and other composers, I think, also a little bit. So it's a real festival theme and built around him.
Alex, what does Beethoven ask of a violinist that maybe other composers do not?
I think the most important thing about Beethoven is it was his role as innovator. I think if you look at the violin sonatas, the early violin sonatas were much like the early trios where Beethoven was basically writing for himself. He was a wonderful pianist and known for that throughout Europe. And what he was basically doing was showcasing his own talent. And later, the early violin sonatas are very much like that. The Opus 12 sonatas are literally a sort of a vehicle for Beethoven to just show himself off. At that point, he starts to sort of go in a different direction. When he gets to the Opus 23, Opus 30 sonatas, you see him sort of verging in a different direction. He's letting the violin sort of have its own voice. The biggest change would come at the fifth sonata, which is titled The Spring, where the violin starts off everything and it's almost this, it brings out the sort of lyrical voice of the violin and lets the violin sort of take over as the commanding voice within the piano and violin duo. Finally, at the, I think probably the pivotal point is at the Opus 47, what's called the Kreutzer Sonata, where he was for the first time able to use a bow created by François Tourte, which is a completely different entity. Before, there was no way to sustain the sound from the frog, the bottom of the bow, all the way to the top of the bow. But for the first time, he could do that. And the very first thing he writes is this incredibly long, sustained lines of chords, which is incredibly difficult for the violin. It's one of the scariest openings of any piece of music for the violin. It's terrifying to play, and it demands an incredible amount of control. But what's interesting is that Beethoven, when you talk about a lot of composers, and you say, well, if they had access, if Bach had access to this bow, you know, he would want his music played in a different way. And I don't think that's actually true, because a great composer like Beethoven gets a new toy, and he writes a completely different style of music from that point onward. So I think that if Bach had access to a Tourette bow, he probably would have written music designed for that bow. But I think that's what's interesting about Beethoven, is that his role as that innovator, he takes what's given to him and then just completely takes music in a direction that you never would have thought possible.
So he was living in a really fertile time and place, right? Vienna at the turn of the 18th century. What made that city such an amazing environment for not just Beethoven, but also his contemporaries that influenced him and that he was influenced by?
Well, I think that you have to understand, I mean, right before this, I mean, you have to talk about all of the Enlightenment things that were going on at the time. I mean, all the great poets, all the great thinkers, the philosophy. And Beethoven was in the middle of that. I mean, he came originally, his father and his grandfather was named Lodewijk, which is a very Dutch name.
Dutch, and yes.
Belgian. He's actually a Belgian, I believe. Wasn't he a Belgian?
It was originally from Belgium, actually.
Yeah, he was
family.
A singer.
Yes. Yeah.
And then Beethoven's father, Johann, was also trained in this in music as well. And then little Ludwig was born in Bonn. And so he was just immediately entrenched in music. From his father and his grandfather, and he goes to Vienna, and suddenly he wants to work with Mozart, but he meets Haydn, and Haydn becomes his strongest influence. So at that time, Vienna was just the seat of everything that was going on culturally. Mm. He had a huge influence.
Center of the world concerning music, actually, at that time. And then, of course, not only the culture, but also, of course, then what was a big influence was the war at that time. And then especially around the moment that the Eroica was written. And so, you know, that whole city actually in all his life influenced him tremendously. And also in the periods that he lived there. I mean, he lived in, I think, about around 25, 30 houses. He was all the time kicked out of his house.
He was very messy, right?
Yes, he was loud. He did not behave really well, did not pay his rent, and was kicked out all the time. And so he lived in quite a bohemian life, if mm-hmm. you can say so, if you would say so. So it was an... It's a lot of contradiction with this guy. I mean, the most unbelievable music, and then certainly it turned out that he was really, you know, having these huge problems of hearing. But still, even during that time, he wrote the most unbelievable music. And it's hardly to believe, still today, that you write music which will stay there for ages and ages and is considered to be maybe the most beautiful music ever written, and he did not hear it himself. It's an amazing thing.
Can you imagine how tortured this guy must have felt?
Yeah.
I mean, he's walking in the Heiligenstadt Testament, which was basically he wrote to his brother a lot about what was going on in his life at the time and how he was feeling at the time. Imagine walking down the street and somebody is coming up behind you yelling your name, trying to get your attention, and you can't hear them.
No.
And your whole life is based upon sound. And for them to... For him to be found out as being deaf would have destroyed his career, as a composer especially.
Is the story true that at the premiere of the Ninth Symphony, he did not hear the applause initially?
Mm-hmm. Well, we were all not there, but I would not think that... maybe he could have felt it, maybe, you know, because what he did was he put his ear at the piano, and then when he would hit, some notes, that he could feel some trillings. But that was about it. It has, you know, this guy has a very dark side, and the drama in his music you can feel actually. Quite often.
If you can imagine, he was deaf. He was starting to lose his hearing at the age of 30.
Hmm.
And he lived and composed until he was 57. So he was born in 1770, died in 1827. Yeah. And so he was deaf for the majority, almost the majority of his, or actually the majority of his performing and composing life. Yeah. So most of that creative output was done while he was deaf.
Yeah.
And to, for the things, the later pieces of music that he wrote were just, to think that he wrote these completely deaf is just mind-boggling. The late quartets, you think, how is that possible that this guy didn't hear? I mean, in his head, he heard these things in his head. And that's just, I mean, it's for me, just it exalts him to a level that not many composers can rise to.
We're speaking this hour with concertmaster Alex Carr of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra and Jaap van Zweden, who is music director of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. The DSO is holding a Beethoven Music Festival from May 1st through May 17th with a series of special live performances at the Dallas City Performance Hall. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, maybe ask a question about Beethoven, tell us your favorite piece of music by Beethoven, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Thanks so much.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. SMU.edu/CPFP.
That was from the first movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, as performed by the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. We are speaking with the DSO's music director, Jaap van Zweden, and concertmaster, Alex Carr. The Dallas Symphony Orchestra is holding its Beethoven Festival May 1st through 17th with a series of live special performances at the Meyerson and also at Dallas City Performance Hall. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Alex, you were saying in the break that this is your favorite Beethoven symphony?
Yeah, actually one of my favorite symphonies of all time. Mm-hmm. It was actually this piece that sort of led me into playing in with an orchestra. Maestro von Zweden was previously, before I was, he was my predecessor as concertmaster of the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra in Amsterdam. And when I was in college at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, I was introduced to, at that time, a laser disc. For those of you who are old enough to remember the laser disc, the previous to the DVD.
Like LP-sized DVDs,
exactly.
Right?
It was an LP-sized DVD, exactly. And it was of the Concertgebouw Orchestra performing the Seventh Symphony with Carlos Kleiber conducting. And I saw that DVD laser disc at the time, and I thought, this is what I want to do for a living. And from then on, and ironically later, I would then go on to be concertmaster of that orchestra that I so much loved on that disc.
Does a composer like Beethoven, on the one hand, you'd think he's so brilliant that it must be simple to, certainly not to, to play him, but does everyone in the orchestra instantly understand what Beethoven intended to do? Or, Jaap, can you talk about how you sort of communicate with the musicians about your ideas about what should come from a particular piece?
Well, the thing is that it is not always what you think you see in the score, mm-hmm. what it is. Beethoven is a composer who has hidden voices.
And oh, I love that.
Yes, that's very interesting. And you have to really to go on a big journey. And that journey is not just for a few weeks to find these hidden notes and hidden lines and things like that. It takes a lifetime. And and even this week, when I read my scores, I found some new things which I did not knew 1, 2, or 3 years ago. And so to dig in the scores by Beethoven is a journey. And then if you have a sort of an, I can say, a clear vision of what you think, how it should sound, then of course it is very important that you get the orchestra behind your ideas. And that whatever you are asking, that they understand that and they agree with it. And so sometimes, you know, I could ask an orchestra to do a phrase at certain way, and then they do it. And then I ask them, do you agree actually afterwards? And then sometimes, you know, especially when I'm in Japan, they say, well, am I allowed to to agree or not agree?
Is this a democracy?
Yeah. Because the thing is that, and that's always the balance for a conductor and an orchestra, mm-hmm. is that in a way it is a democracy. It's because, you know, if I move my arms, you don't hear anything. So, I mean, they have to produce what is in what is in my head in a way. Then, of course, if they play it as you want it and you ask them to play it a certain way, and they will do it. But then there is another thing behind that, and that's that I want them to agree with me so I can really feel that how I feel it, that they feel it as well, like that. And that is I would say not very difficult, but it is always a tricky moment because if they would say, I disagree with you, it's actually fine with me, but then I would like to know how they would like to play it themselves instead of just, you know, saying I disagree. Mm-hmm. Because if I say to you, I disagree with you, then you would like to ask me, well, what do you think then? So that is always a sort of a balance. And the interesting thing is that, especially lately, I see that more and more with the orchestras I work with, is that they have their tradition. I have my tradition. I have my idea of how it should sound. They have that. And then somewhere in the middle, you meet and you agree on things. And it is not like I go to an orchestra, I tell them exactly how I want it, and that's it. Because you go to, you know, an orchestra like the Dallas Symphony Orchestra is an orchestra with an incredible tradition. And I would like to respect that tradition as well. And so, you know, to meet somewhere in the middle is always very important.
Is that a modern approach to conducting? I mean, would that have been familiar to musicians, say, in Beethoven's day?
Ooh. I would say, you know, it's funny. It's hard to think of what that would have been. I can compare it more to what might have happened 50 years ago, mm-hmm. where conductors had a more dominant role in the sense that they could hire and fire at will. But I think that what you see nowadays, first of all, the maestro is a former orchestral musician. He worked as concertmaster of the Concertgebouw for 19 years. From the time he was 19 years old. So he grew up in an orchestra environment. So he knows how everything works in an orchestra. But he has the three components that a conductor needs to bring to sort of gain the trust of the orchestra. Number one, he has a very clear vision. Number two, he has extremely clear hands. And three, he's passionate.
What do you mean by clear hands?
It's so easy to know what he wants by the way he moves his hands. There are some people that have a very a clear vision. They know what they want the orchestra to sound like. However, there are not a lot of conductors that can show it with their hand gestures. And there are and the great conductors have this. People that can – of course, you can explain something to an orchestra. But for an orchestra on stage to be able to trust a music director to show with his hands exactly what they want to hear – it is incredibly important, and it's, you know, it's funny. People talk about another great conductor like Carlos Kleiber, who they say, well, you know, he conducted music. Yeah, but if you really look carefully, if the orchestra needed him, he was right there with a beat. And that's what I love about Maestro van Zweden is that he knows exactly what he wants to hear. He can convey that orally, but also he conveys it with his hands. And so you've got the sort of the trifecta of somebody that can convey to an audience through the orchestra what he wants to hear. And that, I would say, was that prevalent 50 years ago? Yeah, there were conductors that could be clear, and there were conductors that had very clear vision. You had people like Zell, people like Kleiber, people like Abbado, these great artists. that were, but was it more dictatorial? Maybe. But I prefer this type of collaboration.
One of the things that I know, one of the great innovations that, that Beethoven put out there was using voices in a symphony for the first time, right? Can you talk about why that was, I mean, not why it was unprecedented, but how that changed the possibility for symphonic composition?
The interesting thing about what you just asked is that in the Ninth Symphony, you know, just before the singers are starting, actually, there is a big solo for the celli and the basses. Hmm. And it is now known that we all know now that he actually started these sentences which he wrote for the cello and the bass parts. First, he thought about putting voices there. Then he changed it again. He went back to the instrumentation. So he's letting the celli and the basses to sing on their instrument like a real singer, phrase like that. And then finally the first singer comes in. But he was, so he, for me, he was, he did not know exactly when he wanted to have the singers in. And so he, first he started to put on the paper where the singers should start, and then he changed it again. So he was actually, and that's why your question is so, I think, so interesting. He was sort of, he had a sort of inside fight when and why he should have the singers there. But then, of course, that brilliant theme came out. And then I think then from there on, he puts everything together, and it cannot be more perfect than it is now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the telephone now to Ed in Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Chris, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not a performer, just an appreciative listener. There are a couple of passages where I've been listening, and my jaw has just dropped at what I've heard. And since both the maestro and the concertmaster are violinists, I'd like them, if they could, to comment on one such. It's in the Opus 1 Trio Quartet, and I think it's in the Cavatina movement. Mm-hmm. The first violin just goes into the sky. The only other thing that I can think of that's had the same effect on me has been when the soprano soars in Britain's Hymn to St. Cecilia. And since both of you have probably performed that at one point or another, I'm sure you know what I mean. I wonder if you could comment on what it's actually like to perform that particular passage.
Wow. That, actually, I have to say the cavatina from that quartet is probably on my Desert Island discs. I mean, that's one of the most seminal pieces of music that Beethoven ever wrote. And you have to understand that his whole life, as I said before, was about innovation. And Beethoven, when he got to the latter portion of his life, like many other composers, he actually started to write pieces in different in forms that were used much earlier, like the Sonata di Chiesa, things that I mean, forms of music that hadn't been used for centuries. And a lot of composers started doing that. Beethoven did it, Brahms did it later, and they were basically experimenting with different things. So Beethoven in the later quartets is taking – he's using fewer movements but longer movements in a sense of things going from directly from one to the next to the next to the next, ideas that sort of run together. And the cavatina is a movement that it is one of the most beautiful, I would say one of the most singing, longingly singing pieces of music ever written. I think performing that, the difficulty with performing it is the musical patience that one has to have. When you soar to that, I know exactly the passage that you're talking about, and when you soar to that note, to be able to think that Beethoven, with this new tort bow that he had the access of creating a long line on the violin that was never possible beforehand. So he is literally has the possibility of now of turning the violin into a human voice. Okay. And you're exactly right, the way your perception of it, of thinking of it as a song, because that's exactly what it is. And it's terrifying in a sense, that movement, in a sense, because the control, the bow control that's necessary, not just the left hand control to hit those high notes, but the bow control to make it sing like that is very intimidating, but worthwhile, as you've heard. I think a great recording of that, if you've heard the Tokyo String Quartet recording of that with Peter Ungen playing, it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will continue our conversation in just a moment with music director Jaap Bens Vaden and concertmaster Alex Carr of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, which will hold its Beethoven Festival May 1st through May 17th at the Meyerson and also at the Dallas City Performance Hall.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications accepted now for the program, which begins March 31st. smu.edu/CPFP.
That was a fifth of Beethoven, recorded by Walter Murphy and the Big Apple Band. Murphy adapted the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony for that disco track. We are speaking to the Dallas Symphony Orchestra's music director, Jaap Bens Vaden, and concertmaster Alex Carr. There's a Beethoven festival, not including a fifth of Beethoven, which takes place May 1st through 17th at both the Meyerson and the Dallas City Performance Hall. I guess you have to have a sense of humor about things like that. I mean, when all that first happened, and perhaps you remember when that music came out, yep, were serious musicians, like, were you shuddering or were you thinking, well, maybe this will draw people into music that somehow they feel like they have to, that isn't for them initially?
I would say if I would go out and I hear this music and I can dance on it, it's fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to a concert hall and you hear that, that would distract me. So I mean, the important thing is that if you go to a discotheque or wherever you go and you dance and you have this music, it's fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember, you know, at that time when it came out that I was a little bit surprised, but it was okay. As long as you don't go to a concert hall and you hear somebody with a synthesizer doing this music, because that would really make me uncomfortable and unhappy, to be honest.
Well, Sting actually quotes Prokofiev. There's a song by Carlos Santana that quotes the Third Symphony of Brahms. There was actually a rap song. I'm trying to remember who it was, but it had Isaac Stern's recording of the Brahms Violin Concerto.
Mm-hmm.
I remember listening to the song just thinking, wait a minute. I know that recording. Wow. It's a really funny story. I was talking to the pianist, Emmanuel Axe, and when that song by Santana came out, it's actually Santana's playing guitar, and then on top, I can't remember who's singing, the guy who was a club singer in Charlottesville, Virginia, and he's so famous now. Why is this escaping me? Anyway, when that song came out, Manny heard his daughter listening to the song, and he said, you know, it actually comes from this piece of music, and he played it for me. He said, I like this version better.
Yeah.
And he was really unhappy.
That'd be a tough day. Is there anything different about the process of preparing for a recording with an orchestra as opposed to preparing for a live performance?
Well, a recording is very definite.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not on the highest quality, which is being thinkable, you should not bring it out. I think that problem with recordings these days is that you can do it over and over and over and over again till it is perfect. What I like, actually myself, is the live recordings.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it is not as perfect as you wanted, but you can feel that there is an audience there, and you can feel that there is a sort of a relationship between the orchestra and the audience. And that relationship, by the way, which is a fantastic relationship, is a very important one for us, because don't underestimate what the role is of the public. They inspire us if they are really concentrated, if you can almost feel that they want us to do well. And because of that feeling, actually, we do better. And so the relationship and the happening in the hall, being on tape, I prefer that even better than just a clean, perfect recording.
How do you sense an audience when your back is to them for most of the time, unless you turn around to take a bow?
Well, you know, I mean, they see my back, but I can see with my with the back of my head. I mean, this is what I learned when I was a concertmaster in the 80s and 90s. And so, you know, it's the feeling. And, of course, I can see my orchestra in their eyes. Mm. And I can see that they have this fantastic relationship with our audience. And so this is a very inspiring moment always for us to prepare, usually in an empty hall. We have some listeners. And thank God there are more and more schools coming in to have the young people and the young ones to have a nice rehearsal with us. But by looking my people in the eyes and having such a close contact with my orchestra, I can really feel and see what kind of relationship there is with our audience.
I will never forget a performance that we did, the St. Matthew Passion. And I walked out on stage and I sat down and there was a woman in the front row with a baby. Baby could have been more than a year old. And I sat there thinking, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. There's a kid in the front row. This is and one of the most solemn pieces of music ever written, one of the most beautiful pieces of music ever written. In that three-hour concert, that baby never uttered a sound.
Wow.
And the baby was awake. The baby just sat there enraptured by the music. I thought, this is unbelievable. I'd never seen anything. And I actually, at the end of the concert, I looked down at the mother and I said, that is the most incredible child I've ever seen. Put that child in a music school now. Because I've never seen an attention span like that. A three-hour attention for a one-year-old. It was staggering. Staggering.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Paul in Dallas. Hi, Paul.
Hi, thank you. I sang with the symphony chorus for over 22 years. Left just when the maestro came in. Had the privilege of singing with many spectacular conductors and a few that were less spectacular. Just an observation I had is that with the conductors that communicated particularly well were those, at least from the choral standpoint, were those who had either done a lot of choral work and particularly those who had conducted quite a bit of opera. I found that the opera conductors had a real feel for the voice and how to draw out the choral voices and the singing voices particularly well. And I don't know if the maestro had ever conducted much opera, but would be curious to know.
Thanks for your call.
Well, thank you for asking, and I really like your observation. Opera plays a huge role in my life. I'm actually in the middle of a series of recordings of Wagner operas. I already recorded the Meistersinger and Lohengrin and what else? Parsifal. And I'm doing around two operas a year. But of course, we have an opera house in Dallas here. And they have their own music director, so you will not see me there a lot. And but at the other hand, we are trying to do more and more opera in concert. We did the Walküre, we did the Beethoven opera, and what we will do in the future is that I know that we are going to tour, for instance, in 16 to Europe, and we are going to take the Walküre with us on tour, and Richard Wagner, and. In the festival, which we are going to start next year, we will also do some vocal pieces. And in 2016, we are planning to do the Zauberflöte, Mozart. So more and more, of course, with respect for next door, for the opera house, and we do that together. You know, we will bring an opera, which they, of course, will not bring in that season because we are... colleagues and good colleagues, and we like to see what's going on there. But my personal feeling with opera is that if you don't conduct opera, you are not a complete conductor. And I think that the human voice is the most important and impressive instrument on earth. First is the human voice, and then it's a lot of other instruments, but it's the instrument. So I completely agree with him, and it's too bad that he did not sing with me, because I always like to meet people who are interested in the orchestra and in performances. And but I do hope to see him in the hall and see him as a listener.
It's funny, I was having this exact discussion this morning with a musician I very much respect, and we were IMing about this exact subject, about conductors and their training, and we were discussing the fact that a lot of conductors that used to have a lot of training in opera houses often went on to become the best conductors around, and that one thing that's lacking these days is that for the young conductors to have sort of apprenticeships, internships in opera houses. And Maestro conducts so much opera. I mean, that's one of the things that makes him, I mean, probably one of the things that makes him such a great accompanist when it comes to accompanying soloists, but also somebody whose hands are so effortlessly clear. Because when you have to deal with a lot of things going on at once, when you're in control of an entire opera, that's a lot of things to control at once from the podium. And you have to be clear with your hands, clear with your heart. And I think that that's something that's lacking in the training of a lot of young conductors these days, is that kind of opera experience.
We just have a few seconds left, but do y'all want to talk about highlights from the festival? Things we should be – we can find the whole schedule online, but anything we should be particularly paying attention to?
No. That, I mean, every night is for me a highlight. And just to be on stage again and be back in Dallas after a long time not being here is a highlight for me. And but I'm particularly myself very happy with the chamber music around our orchestra these days.
Jaap van Zweden is music director of the Dallas Symphony Orchestra. Alex Carr is the orchestra's concertmaster. The DSO is holding a Beethoven Festival May 1st through 17th at the Dallas City Performance Hall and the Meyerson. It's been such a pleasure to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to all of you listening today. We really appreciate it. We appreciate those of you who have called in and written in. Thanks.